accession number 27083, reel 33.
Sir Henry, you said that in the wardroom you had a good first
lieutenant. I had a good first lieutenant. I had a good navigating officer. I had a very good gunner, Taz, torpedo anti-submarine. And the rest, frankly, were bordering on the mediocre. So it was a not very experienced and not strikingly competent team. Well, as I've said, every night or every other night I would sneak up to the bridge and do my eyesight test, self-imposed, and it was hopeless, absolutely hopeless. And the time came, the 3 weeks ran out all too quickly, and it was the Friday came, and we were due to sail on the Monday. And on the Friday evening, with a very heavy heart, I clambered up to the bridge for the last time to try this out. And it was the same. Double vision, two lights for every one, quite impossible to berth a ship under those conditions, and so forth. And I thought, well, that's it, you know, shall I, is that the end of me? And as I was bringing my binoculars down to my chest, I must have tilted them somehow. And instantly became aware that everything came good. I couldn't understand this. And so I put my binoculars up again, everything double and blurred and so forth, and then tilted them up a bit, and everything came good. This is an ophthalmological, well-known ophthalmological phenomenon, I'm told, but I wasn't aware of it at the time. And I was really using the yardstick, my ability efficiently to use a pair of binoculars after dark. After all, I had 250 lives dependent on it, and this was important. And so I tried this act, 20, 30 times. And it was about 9 o'clock at night. And it worked every time. So elated, I rushed down to my cabin, told the duty officer to order a cab, and rushed up to Wembley House. And they'd had a dinner party there. And since he and his male guests were out in the billiard room playing slosh. And I burst in on them and went up to the CNC. His name will come back to me in a moment, and he was a famous man and a marvelous man. I went up to him and said, "Sir, it's all right. I can see." And this was a last-minute thing because I was due to sail on Monday, but I had promised to report to him. And he looked at me pretty unbelievingly. And he handed me his cue, and the rest of the players stopped. And he put the red ball in the center spot and led me around the far, fortunately, side. And rolled the white towards me and said, "Pot the red ball." And I thought, God, because I had to look down, which was fatal. And no binoculars to help me out and that sort of thing. So I went down practically onto my knees in order to look up.
Not to look down.
And so forth. And lined up. And eventually, you know, I had to make my shot. And I potted the red. And I thought, God. And I stood up and looked at my CNC, and with a beaming smile he said, "Pass." And that was it. De facto, that was another life. And there we were. Well, we left on the Monday. I said goodbye to Mary, and we sailed for Portland. And we were at Portland for 8 weeks, where the rest of the squadron were, too. And we all worked up. Mainly an individual ship thing, rather than the squadron thing, then. The appointers had made, perpetrated what they thought was a clever joke, apart from the leader, and apart from the canteen boat, the most junior chap. There were three of us, all commanders, in the squadron, different ships. We were all the same half year in the Navy List, separated by two or three places. So this was quite a needle thing. Well, we had a good workup, in the course of which, and I was very thin in any case at the time, I lost 2.5 stone. I don't know where it came from, but it came from somewhere. And then out we went to the Mediterranean. And we were due to go to Malta, which we did, and to relieve a squadron of Darings, which were somewhat bigger. And being bigger, and because there were practically no cruisers left in the Navy by then, there were the guided missile destroyers, called such, they were effectively light cruisers, and this was just a device to get them through the naval estimates. And the Darings were, they were much more powerful than a light cruiser before the war, put it that way. And we were going to leave them, and because they were that much bigger, and they were short of sea jobs for them, they were commanded by captains. And we went out there and arrived at Malta, and we berthed in Slema Creek, which I can show you in an old picture out there. Have you been to Malta, do you know?
I haven't, but of course I've heard many stories of Slema Creek.
Slema Creek.
Yes.
Well, suffice it to say that coming in from Seawood and berthing in Slema, you came through the narrows, and they were quite narrow, the entrance, and then you put the wheel hard over, and you went astern on the inner screw, and you slewed the ship through 90 degrees to line her up, to be precise, to line her stern up with the lie of the creek up which you were going to pass, and you were going to do so stern first, so that you were facing to seaward and could slip and get out in a hurry if necessary. Very sensible arrangement. Quite a tricky maneuver, because ships don't steer well going astern, and so on. And to do it, you had to put your bow practically on the shoreline. But it was very steep, too, so that was safe. Well, this, of course, was the first time that I'd done it, or pretty well. I'd done it, I suppose, in javelin before, slightly, but unofficially. And that was very different. And anyway, Dunkirk was considerably bigger. And we made it all right. And I think everybody, from myself downwards, was so relieved that we got there and we got to a good position between our two boys. And we were so busy heaving a sigh of relief. Not very much happened for a moment. And this was noted by the Admiral, unfortunately, who was standing not very far away, looking down on us, and so on. Well, then, he, the Admiral, who was Desmond Dreyer, charming man, who had been the first gunnery officer in Duke of York when I joined her, and a very fine one, too, and he had us all on board to welcome us, and he gave us dinner, and he made it quite clear that we were going to have our welcome before and during dinner. And at the end of dinner, we were required to go at once and not even wait for coffee, because he was then having the Darings squadron captains on board for coffee and liqueurs by way of saying goodbye to them. And that was that. Well, that was easy from our point of view. And I heard subsequently that the Admiral had turned to the Daring's captains by way of conversation, really, and said, well, you know, this is, I suppose, now you've done your last slimmer. You'll never do another slimmer, because if they'd got another command, it would be bigger and it wouldn't be in slimmer, etc. And he turned to the senior one, the leader, and said, how do you feel about that? Oh, said the leader, it was, you know, he didn't know how he was going to live without his slimmer. And he went on a bit, and eventually ran out of steam, and the Admiral turned to the next captain and said, how do you feel, Senator? Oh, I agree. No, it's in the blood. It's part of the Navy, and it's life will be missing something without Seema. And they all rabbited on like this. Then they got to the last one, who was a gunnery officer called Geoffrey Carew Hunt. He's dead now, poor chap. And he was turned to last of all, and he said, you're a lot of rotten bastards. I'll be honest, I had fucking kittens every time I did it, and so did you. And that was that, and they rather broke up into slaughter after that. I had then to, amongst other things, to call, you know, that was later.
May I just take this opportunity just to ask a general question?
Yeah.
You are a gunnery officer.
Yes.
You've had various posts at sea, various ships. But how much ship handling experience have you ever gained? I've just heard that you had a chance at doing something in Javelin, which is the first time I've heard you mention it. How much?
You have heard of that before when I was talking about Javelin.
Oh, I do apologize.
When we had a after the mutiny, and we had a new captain.
Yes.
Who never handled the ship. And I'd taken over as navigating officer.
You're absolutely right. I'm sorry.
And I did handle the ship.
No, you're absolutely right.
And that was the only time, the only ship handling experience that I'd ever previously had. But, of course, this has to happen. It has to be a first for everything, for everybody.
So the Navy gives you command of this massively expensive piece of kit with 250 men on board, and you've only ever done a bit of ship handling before.
And I was lucky.
And you have to learn
have it.
And you have to learn on the job.
Yes.
Heavens above. I mean, you could crash into anything, couldn't you?
You could. But there are interlocks. There are plenty of other people who say, oh, I stay there on time. And that sort of thing. But, that's the hazard of the life.
Okay.
That's the hazard of being wet rather than dry.
Yes, of course.
We went to we went back to Gibraltar. We must have called there on the way through, I think. And we did a particular exercise there. And we were in harbour after that exercise when the weather blew up. And I was berthed in a particular jetty that was directly opposite the main entrance to the inner harbour. And you got a hefty old swell coming through the entrance, and so on. And I remember that evening, one of my fellow CAs had come to visit me on board, and you could feel the ship twitching against the catamaran, against the jetty. And even he remarked, this is very unpleasant, isn't it? And of course, we had steam at 4 hours' notice, which was the normal for harbour. And this got worse. And so I demanded, they had a system there whereby, because of this danger of the swell coming through and ships bumping on the jetty or onto the cats and so forth, especially the cats, you had what were called holding off wires, one forward and one aft, stout wires that were led to a submerged anchor on the bottom of the harbour, and you hold them taut so that if the swell came in, the strain came in the wires, and you were held off from bashing against the side with the ship. Well, we had these wires on, of course, and they were fully tautened up and all that, but we were still bumping. And so after a bit, I made a signal to the flag officer at Gibraltar, requesting tugs to shift berth. And it was something like 4 hours before I got one. And we did in the course of the early part of the evening. I suppose it was 9 or 10 o'clock by then. And the warden were due to dine me out, or dine me in, rather. And it was all a bit unhappy, because we by then had punched a hole in our side on the catamaran. And that meant we had to be docked for repairs and so forth. And we sat down in the wardroom for this delayed dinner, feeling a bit chastened. And it was close on midnight. And the next thing that happened was that the duty officer came up to me and whispered in my ear that there was a case of indecency that had been discovered, followed on one of the mess decks. And they say that things happen in threes and so forth. I rather wondered what number three was going to be, but we didn't get one. That was enough for one night, and so on. And the net result was that the rest of the squadron returned to Malta, and we stayed on to be docked in Gib, and we stayed on for what effectively was a refit, which we were shortly due to have in any case. And that meant one got to know Gibraltar pretty well, and the people there, a very small community. And Mary, my wife, came out, and we managed to get hold of a very basic, tiny little cable and wireless flat, and so on. And it was at about that stage that my chief bosun's mate, who was the senior seaman, chief petty officer on board, a very worthy and responsible position, and a very nice man this was, but he took to the bottle, and evidently so. And half the time he was one of the odds. He was drunk, and I had him relieved, of course, had to. And he was sent back home with a full report to be dealt with by the medics and to be dried out. And I thought that was the end of it. He was an extremely nice man, but there was no question of him being put in charge of replenishing at sea where lives were at stake and who had to give orders fairly fast and entirely correctly, professionally, and so forth. I'll come back to that in a moment. One of the indeed, pretty well the only thing that I knew was fundamentally wrong about the ship, apart from the fact we'd got a small hole in our side, and that meant a bit of replating, was the steering gear. And the steering gear, which was fairly old-fashioned, was, to say the least, very stiff indeed. And I'd reported this as a defect, and so we were there for a couple of months or so, and they had their time which to put it right. And I made a number of friends in Malta, mainly, curiously, in the army. The garrison commander and the chief engineer officer became very firm friends, and their families, and that was fine. But the admiral, the flag officer of Gibraltar, was somewhat different. And when I first went to call on him to write my name in his book, and I filled the taxi up with my officers, and then sent it back to get the other half and that sort of thing, so they all wrote their names in his book as an act of courtesy, and also hopefully to get ours for the odd meal or cocktail party or whatever. And I had no complaints about that, and I was asked to lunch or dinner two or three times and so forth. But throughout our two and a half month refit, not one of my officers was asked of anything. We were the only ship in. This is odd. He was a curious man, and he behaved in a curious way. He had the reputation, when he'd been captain, I think of a daring, of having had acute promotionitis. Now, promotionitis is an unattractive trait in anybody at any stage. But for a captain to have it really seriously, because he wanted to become a flag officer, is bordering on the insufferable. And by reputation, he'd had it, meaning the promotionitis. Nevertheless, somehow, he became a rear admiral, and he was sent to Gibraltar.
You haven't mentioned his name, Sir Henry.
I haven't.
No, you haven't.
I think he may be still alive, so perhaps I won't. But suffice it to say that the one thing that really featured in his mind was a play which was put on at Admiralty House, The Mount, as it was called in Gibraltar, and it was rather run by his secretary, who was a paymaster commander. And the life of the naval life of the ROC really revolved around working up for this play and so forth. I was unimpressed with this. I had, most of my friends were in the army and not in the navy. I was unimpressed by the chief engineer officer, who I didn't think had a grip of anything. I was very unimpressed by the admiral. And in the moment of boredom or whatever, I remarked, I can't remember who to now, but I remarked rather too publicly for discretion, I referred to him as Fumbletum. And that's exactly what he looked like, you know. He was short and plump and had a belly and not very good at taking decisions and so forth. And Gibraltar being a very tight community, it was round the ROC in a flash. And I thought, God. So I watched my tongue a bit more then. Well, in due course, the refit came to an end. And we went to sea for trials. And we tried everything there was to be tried and so forth, including, and not least, the steering gear. And the coxswain, who is normally put on the wheel of a destroyer for precise manoeuvring, like going alongside or replenishment and that sort of thing, and he's the most experienced, so forth. He quite rightly reported that the steering gear was no better. In fact, if anything, it was rather worse. And so I personally went down, and we were in the open sea then, I went down and tried the wheel myself, and I could hardly turn it. And it was an impossible situation for any form of precise manoeuvring. So I came up with a signal, and I addressed it to the flag officer, Gibraltar, copied it to my Captain D, copied it to my flag officer, Destroyers, and I also copied it to the Commander-in-Chief. And very quickly, there was a reaction. There wasn't much reaction from Flag Officer Gibraltar, but he sent somebody down who didn't make it any better. My Captain D sent the Fleet Engineer Officer, who knew a thing or two about this, and the leader was also a battle-class destroyer, where he was. And he came on board, and within, 24 hours or less, he put it right. But the signal had gone, of course, and it had been copied to the Commander-in-Chief. This reflected ill on the Flag Officer Gibraltar, who was also the Admiral Superintendent in the dockyard. and so on. Well, shortly after that, and still with the squadron engineer officer with me, it came to me to make my final call on Fumbleton, which I did at about, noon. And I took with me the squadron engineer officer, in case he wanted any details. My own engineer officer was a nice little man, but he had spent his previous 11 years in gunnery engineering, ordnance engineering. And this was his first ship for 11 years. And he didn't really know very much about it. And it wasn't entirely his fault, but he was an engineer officer and he was being given his steam chance, as it were, and so forth. Perfectly nice chap, very loyal, very keen, not very efficient, I'm afraid, and certainly not very knowledgeable. And when I went in to the Admiral to take leave, I asked him if he would like me to bring the squadron engineer officer in. No, he said, certainly not. So he remained in the outer office. And I waited to see what he would say next. And he said, I'm not disposed to take the matter of your engineer officer lightly. Oh, I said, what is it you have in mind, sir? I shall almost certainly court-martial him, he said, over the question of your steering gear, as if it was my engineer officer's fault, which it was not. And by this time, my blood was beginning to boil a bit. And so I said, well, sir, as to who you court-martial and who you do not, of course, is entirely a matter for you to decide. But if you do decide to court-martial my engineer officer, I shall appear in court as prisoner's friend, and I can assure you I shall have some very penetrating questions to ask of the engineering staff at this dockyard. And that was the last word, and he sort of pointed to the door, and I left, and I never heard any more about it. And that was that. And that's the last time I ever saw him, fortunately. We returned to Malta, and shortly after we got in, I called on the Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean, who was a man called Bingley, normally known as Baron Bingley, a great big chap. He was an aviator, and he had a much younger wife who was really rather fun, and she didn't give a fig for protocol and man or beast, and would appear for a full long-dress dinner with a sort of, without wearing stockings and probably sandals and a short dress of knee length and looking really, and charmingly too, as if she'd come straight off the hockey field. She was one of those, and she got away with it, and so forth. She was not present, of course, when I called on the Commander-in-Chief up in Lascaris in Malta. And I went in, and there was the great man sitting behind a huge desk, and he sat me down in a chair alongside his desk. The more normal custom is that if somebody is coming to call on you and you're the Commander-in-Chief, doesn't matter who he is, he can be a midshipman, but you leave your desk and you take him over to an occasional table and you sit him in an armchair and you sit in another one, and it's a bit less stuffy and formal, but not so here. He remained sitting behind his vast desk, and I was put in a chair beside him. And there was a huge, heavily carved wooden box on one edge almost of his desk. And he said, do you smoke? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he pointed at the box. And I opened the box. I'd never forgotten it. And there in the bottom were two, do you know what I mean by blue line cigarettes?
No, I don't, no.
Well, there were duty-free cigarettes, which were what the name implies, and they had H.M. Forces Any or something printed on them. and there was a thing called a Blue Line cigarette, which was sort of halfway between a duty-free and full duty. And you got them in a ship. I think you got them in a shore establishment, and you got them in a ship if you were in refit and not on, not actively seagoing, that sort of thing. And in the bottom of this vast box were two very mouldy Blue Line cigarettes. However, the die was cast. I'd asked for it. I'd got it. I had said that I smoked, so I had to take one of these and not one of my own from my own pocket. And I had great difficulty in getting it to light up, even, and so forth. Now, you'll think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. There weren't very many ships out in the Mediterranean at the time. There was our squadron. There was a minesweeping squadron. There might have been a couple of cruisers. That was it. Occasionally, other ships, of course, called in, passing through en route somewhere else, but not as part of the fleet, and so on. So it was all a bit top-heavy, and this was a hangover from the past. And then the great man turned to me and said, "Now, let me see. Where have you just come from?" And I said, "Just come from Gibraltar." "Ah, yes," he said. "Yes, yes, yes." And